Let's start with the bottom line. Alaska produced 19 billion barrels of oil and saved $50 billion. Norway produced 29 billion barrels and saved $500 billion, 10 times more. A delegation of Alaskans went to Norway recently to find out how they did that. How could Alaska end up richer when the oil is gone? That's our topic today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Reconnect with family and friends in Anchorage this fall. Explore the diverse shops, restaurants, and attractions. Catch Fiddler on the Roof and other Broadway shows. And find cool events like Alaska Federation of Natives Convention or simply enjoy PFD shopping. For big deals and more wild ways to play, visit anchorage.net/fall. This message is sponsored by the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm sitting in today for Steve Heimel on Talk of Alaska. And we have a topic which is about as fundamental to any in all of our lives that we would like to admit, which is the oil industry and how we handle our oil resources in Alaska. Pays for 90% of our state government, supports an enormous portion of our economy, and we all know that the oil is sort of what puts bread on the table for many, many Alaskans. Well, there's more than one way to handle that resource wealth, more than one way to deal with the oil industry and figure out how to handle the wealth that comes from it. And Alaska has chosen one path, and Norway has chosen another. In Alaska, we put a portion of our oil wealth into a permanent fund, and we save some. I guess we've got about $36 billion in the permanent fund now and about $15 billion in just savings that the legislature can use. The rest of it we spend as it comes into the state, or you know, through the taxing regime, it's maybe reinvested or goes to corporate bottom line. In Norway, they're saving all of their oil revenues and using only the savings from it. They do it quite a different way. And so to learn how that all worked, a delegation of Alaskans from the Institute of the North, this is the institute that Governor Wally Hickel started years ago, went to Norway. It was a large delegation to learn, well, how's Norway doing it? And is there anything we could learn about what they're doing that would be beneficial here in Alaska? And I've got two guests today who went on that trip, and they're going to explain what they learned and how it might be applicable and answer your questions. In just a couple of minutes here, I'll give you the phone number and email address so you can get on the show. Ira Perman is the chairman of the Institute of the North and was one of the leaders of the trip. Ira, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us on, Charles.
And Rebecca Logan is the general manager of the Alliance, which is the group that brings together the oil support industry. And thanks for being with us, Rebecca.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
So, Ira, what's the 101 version or the short version of what we mean when we say the Norway model as opposed to the Alaska model, and what made you want to learn about it?
Well, first, what made us want to learn about it, the Institute of the North every year hosts a dialogue, a think tank up in Talkeetna, and we look at best practices in many different areas around the world, and Norway keeps coming up on the radar screen for having great practices in education, great practices in workforce development, certainly all of their the dashboard economic indicators for Norway are just phenomenal. And of course, as you just outlined, what they've done with their oil in terms of their version of a permanent fund compared to ours really caught everybody's attention. And so for a few years, we tried to get someone from Norway to come over and explain to us how do they do that. But it turned out we couldn't get anybody over, so the Norwegian consul here said, well, why don't you go over there? And that struck a chord. And so the Institute of the North put together this policy tour to learn how Norway deals with energy. And that's not just their oil and gas, which they export, but also what they use internally, which is a totally different story.
Rebecca, what interested you from an industry perspective in going over there?
Well, first of all, taking a trip to Norway.
Right.
Actually, my board just had a great interest in learning about the model also. You know, we've been very involved in the last year in trying to work with our policy leaders here in the state to figure out what we need to do to make our business climate here more competitive and what we need to do to very specifically increase production. Right. And one thing you notice when you go over to Norway is that they're in production with oil and gas. And so that was really attractive to our board, you know, to figure out, you know, why that was and if there was anything we could learn from that.
Now, your members are capitalists. I mean, they're running companies and involved in.
They are.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got 460 members. They employ about 35,000 people in the state of Alaska, which is more than 10% of the workforce.
And these are the companies that are assisting the oil industry essentially in getting the oil out.
Oil, gas, and mining, and it's a wide variety. It's anything from drillers to bankers to insurance companies to engineers. Very wide mm-hmm. variety of people.
Well, aren't they allergic to socialism? I mean,
could be.
Yeah,
I think people are at the point right now where we're so frustrated about having the resources that we have and not producing them that people are really open to hearing what works.
It's ironic that we'd go to Norway, a socialist country, to learn something about developing oil and gas.
Yeah, well, that's something that I really want to explore this hour, and I'm really interested in hearing what the listeners think and what their point of view may be. If you're calling from within Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. From outside Anchorage, it's a toll-free number statewide, 1-800-478-8255. And we also take email comments at talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Ira, can you fill us in a little bit more on what makes what they do different? How do they... and I know it's a long answer, but give us a few highlights of what's different about the way Norway interacts with its oil resources compared to Alaska.
Well, for us, it was a long process of discovery. We knew the big numbers, but we didn't know how they got to it. And you're asking me to kind of jump to the end of the conclusion here, which by the end we had come to the realization that Norway and its oil industry work much closer together. They work in alignment, where in Alaska you might make the argument that Alaska works its sort of counterpoint. It's highly regulatory. Our whole system here, even with our federal government, is adversarial. All you need to do is talk to Shell and look at the frustration they're having right now with one lawsuit after another. That doesn't happen in Norway. But the question is, how do they get that alignment? Why is it that the oil companies that work there in Norway get along so well together? And what we discovered is it took them a while to get there. They didn't initially have that system, but they developed a system where Norway and the oil industry are basically on the same side of the table when it comes to developing their resources. They want to have those resources developed. They work hard to work the systems out to make it move faster. They can take production from a license agreement into full production in as little as 2 years, which you said.
Yeah, that was impressive. That was very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does the environmental community fit into that? Because one thinks of them as being a fairly liberal country with a pretty strong environmental movement.
Well, I think they engage them pretty early on in the process. I mean, I think the one thing that they have that we're lacking is a very predictable, transparent, stable process. And so it's very early in the game that they get the stakeholders involved. You know, they have just as many fisheries issues as we do. And so they bring people, and the state is very involved in that, to the table very early to work out the issues ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see, and I don't know that we ever got a really clear answer on why this was, but you don't see the lawsuits that happened after the process is complete that actually stymie resource development. Mm-hmm. Though we asked people about it, it was kind of foreign to them. I mean, we didn't get a real clear answer.
They seem to have a specific place in the process where the opportunity to voice your
right
opposition or your concerns is there, and it's dealt with, and once it's dealt with, that's it.
That's it, and you move on.
Well, do they have also a more... more of a consensus or more of a cohesive community, in that here in Alaska we have some very broadly diverse points of view, people who very strongly disagree. Is it a little bit more?
I think so. You know, they are so proud to stand up and say we are a socialist democrat country, and you know, a big mm-hmm. part of that is sharing resources and what you'd call class collaboration. Seriously, mm-hmm. you know, people want to work together for the benefit of the country, and they fund their their philosophical system by developing their resources. So everybody wins from that, with universal health care, with paying for education through a PhD for people. I'm going to send my kid over there.
I've already told my daughter about this.
Go to school in Norway. But
free so secondary education.
It is different. Mm-hmm. It doesn't appear to be as controversial there. People are working together to have that happen.
Well, I guess I read that then I don't want to jump to the end of the discussion, but to what extent is this really applicable then if we live in a very different kind of society than they live in? Can we really take some of their ideas and use them here in Alaska?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's probably the bottom line question is what from Norway, what either individual aspects or what whole systemic approaches could we use here? I did a presentation a couple of nights ago, and a gentleman stood up and said, you're saying that government and oil industry trust each other? How can that be? I just can't imagine how that could possibly work here. How could we trust our government to do the right thing?
Mm-hmm. And we trust it less and less all the time.
It seems that way. Now, to a certain degree, we have some success stories. I mean, mm-hmm. for example, our permanent fund corporation is a good arm's length from direct involvement by our elected officials. And that seems to be the key over in Norway, too, is they put their bureaucracies, if you will, out of reach of the elected officials. We were meeting with people that weren't the ministers, weren't the deputy ministers, but were the next person down. The ministers and deputy ministers change with whoever the majority party is. But once you get below that level, their staff, they stay in place and they have clear guidelines and criteria for doing things, and it seems to work pretty well. At least over there, it's a pretty well trusted
mm-hmm,
system.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the eye catching things here is the fact that they've pumped, I guess, less than twice as much oil as Alaska has, and yet they've saved 10 times as much money, and I guess they don't have a dividend. How do they go about that? Just in a practical sense, how do they save so much money?
It's pretty basic. They save and we spend. They mm-hmm. take every penny they get from the resource development and put it into that fund. And it's called the government pension fund, but it's not a pension fund. They don't pay anything out of it. And they have like a 4% POMV. So they put everything they earn from the oil industry into that fund, and they're allowed to touch it once a year up to 4% to use for the national budget. And even when they don't always use up to 4% of it. And the most it ever contributes to the national budget is 10%. So they save it, we spend it.
I see.
It's very much similar to the concept we have here of an endowment mm-hmm. or foundation. Endowments are meant for the future, for future generations in perpetuity. Well, they did some pretty good math over there, and they figured out the only way you can do that is to put all that money in there and not spend more than the fund can inflation proof itself, which is in there
4%.
But they have an economy outside of oil too that's paying.
Well, that's right, and a lot of historical situations have lent to Norway's success. Norway, as you mentioned, is a very well diversified, solid economy. It has it's very diversified. It's got farming, it's got fishing, it's got industry, it's got boat building. It's everywhere. It's a 1,000-year-old culture. It's not like Alaska, where other than the Alaska natives, the rest of us are pretty recent here. They've been around since the Vikings, and they have a solid economy. Oil came on slowly there. It didn't come on all at once like it did here. So they were never tempted to do away with their taxation structure. As you know, Norwegians are taxed fairly heavily.
Heavily for personal income tax.
The personal income tax is pretty high, and they have a sales tax that'll knock your socks off.
Yeah. $8 for a Diet Coke was a little much.
$18 for a beer.
Yeah.
I like to say that our delegation was extremely sober. We could simply not afford.
It was forced.
It was forced. And a big part of that was because 25% sales tax on things. So they didn't do away with that. So they have had the economic ability as a country to support that very generous social system. And the oil came on slowly. And so before they knew it, though, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. They said, well, what are we going to do with all this money? And here's the interesting thing. In the 1980s, as it was starting to grow, they looked around the world and said, are there other places like this that have had this problem of too much money? And they found Alaska. of all places.
And they studied our
And they sent a delegation over to Juneau to meet with the folks at the Permanent Fund Corporation and studied our permanent fund. Liked very much what they saw. They said, this is a great way to save for the future. Your oil resource is a one-time, non-renewable. Put money aside for the future. They went back to Norway, made a few changes and improvements, and hence their system.
Wow.
Where they put all of their money, all of their oil resource money in it. And that's comprised of their taxes. They have a 78% flat tax on their oil and gas.
78%?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
We'll come to that in a minute.
Okay.
Because that's actually lower than ours.
So the taxes, they also have dividends from Statoil, which they own two-thirds of.
So they own a large portion of the oil industry.
They own 67% of Statoil.
Okay.
And finally, the part we haven't talked about is that the state acts like an oil company and actually directly invests in its oil fields, and to the extent that they reap rewards from those risky investments, that goes in there too. So those three sources of funds move into that fund.
Plus the high taxes on the other industries, on the populace.
That doesn't go into their permanent fund.
Oh, I see. That's paying for government so they can put the money in
that's
the
right.
permanent fund.
That's right.
All right. Well, let me, I think that, I mean, it sounds like a big part of this is taxation. And that's something that Alaskans are always interested in talking about. So let's
or avoiding talking
yes.
about
it.
at least the fact that we're an incredible place in terms of our low taxes for individuals, if not for oil companies. The phone number, if you want to talk to us and get involved or ask questions, is 550-8422. That's in Anchorage. Outside of Anchorage, it's toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And my name is Charles Woolforth. I'm sitting in today for Steve Heimel. My guests are Ira Perman, who's chairman of the Institute of the North, and Rebecca Logan, who's general manager of the Alliance, which represents the support industry for resource development. And now I'd like to go to Caroline, who's called in with a question or comment. Caroline?
Yes, good morning. I was at the presentation that Chris Rose made along with Ira Perman. Ira, it was an extremely beneficial night and a lot of things that surprised me, especially after having 15 years in the industry from TAPS to North Slope to working here, as you know, because we knew each other way back in the day. And some of the things that surprised me, first of all, Americans are very competitive. I think it comes from our frontier spirit from the beginning of the nation, and there are winners and losers. That's part of our approach to things, and we label things like socialism is labeled, and the as the lady said, socialist Norway, socialist democratic party. They look for the opportunity costs that we sometimes bear. By not having a well-educated and healthy nation. Those are some things that really cost us. The approach they take on owning the resource, they definitely see themselves as the owners of the resources, and also they open up the information. You said that they do their own, they own all of the information on the geology of a field, and it's available to everyone. So all of the companies that are going to bid, and they get a chance to bid on what the country decides it wants to let out. It's not a lease. It's a license. It has a six-year term. And the fact that they go for the best record, not the lowest price, that's another one. So the whole attitude of working together comes out of the fact that they determine how much of the field the country, is going to own.
Well, Carolyn, thanks.
They're part of that development. And to me, that would be great if we could get to that, but it's going to take a total shift in attitude. And I didn't realize, because I don't remember you saying it, that Norway came to us to find out. And when their fund is at $550 billion, did you say, with a projected total of $1 trillion by 2019. I mean, those figures boggle the mind. Obviously,
Caroline, let's let Ira comment. Go ahead, Ira.
Caroline, it's good to hear your voice again. There's a lot of things you brought up there. One of the most interesting things we learned over there that you brought up was their their system of making tracts of continental shelf real estate available for development. We had it pointed out to us emphatically by their top oil and gas guy that they do not lease, they license. And we all said, what does that mean? He said, well, you lease, you have royalties and you have bids, and you give your awards to the highest bidder, the one who's got the biggest check in the envelope. We don't do that. We give it to the one that has the best work plan. We basically say, here's a tract of land, or tract of, in this case, Outer Continental Shelf, because all of Norway's gas and oil is in the Outer Continental Shelf. Give us a work plan for how you would develop it. Now, one thing they do prior to that, two things that they do prior to that, Carolyn mentioned this, they provide initial two-dimensional seismic. That means they go out there, they pay for it, they have it done, and they make that available to anybody who wants to apply for a license.
And that's for listeners, that's where you go out and you shoot sound into the ground and figure out what the structures are under the ground.
So that's right.
It's a pretty basic data that just says there might be something here.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So anybody applying for a license can take a look at that data and say, well, there is or there isn't something there. They can certainly tell when it's not a likely prospect, and they can get some sense that the formations are such that there might be something down there. So they know something right off the bat that here is not known. And in Norway itself knows something as well. So they make that available. And anybody can get that. It's posted on the web.
One other quick thing. I remember the history. I was here at the time when the legislature, some people thought, well, we should invest in the TAPS line. And I was one who said, no way, because our leadership had blown through $900 million, the original amount of money that was available for the state from the leases that had gone on sale on the North Slope. And, you know, it's a shame.
How much would we have made?
That we had that fear of our own opportunity to do some of what they have been doing.
Yeah, Caroline, that's a great point, and I'm going to let you go, but I want to follow up on that, which is that actually it was Governor Bill Egan who wanted the state of Alaska to build the Alaska Oil Pipeline and own it, and ran into a couple of problems. One was that there was no way they were going to be able to borrow that much money because the state was not rich enough to build a $9 billion pipeline. But it goes back to sort of the owner-state philosophy of Governor Hickel, who founded the Institute of the North. And I guess part of that, you know, Governor Hickel's concept was that accountability would prevent there from being corruption in that kind of situation. But I think that a lot of people, when they hear, well, you don't give the lease or the license to the highest bidder, and you have the government owning the corporations, would be worried that you would have corruption and that there'd be self-dealing. And if you're not judging it by the highest bidder, how do you know you got how do you know you had a fair deal? And I guess I'd be interested in both of you responding
well,
to that.
Well, they put a lot of emphasis on the work plans and work commitments. You know, and so when somebody gets a license, and another important thing to recognize is that there's not like in most cases there is an operator and then four or five other companies working that license in that tract, and so it's not just one winner. And Statoil is the operator on about 80% of their projects right now, but they put a really strong emphasis on the work plan down to the detail of what are you going to do to impact the local committee, how are you going to, or the local community, how are you going to work that local community on workforce development and making sure that maybe their fisheries aren't affected, you know, or getting their people to work, you know. And so there's a significant amount on that, and then all of them have work commitments. And I can't remember, did they ever tell us that they took somebody's license away because they didn't honor the work commitment?
Yes, they have. They have 6 years to make good on it, and if you don't make good on it, the license is simply not renewed.
It's not renewed, okay.
They rarely renew a license. And they had some instances, some heartbreaking ones, of oil companies that went and drilled and drilled and drilled and
didn't do anything.
They gave the license to the next one drilled down 10 more feet and hit.
But the oil industry goes along with it. And then
The licensing is very criteria based.
Mm-hmm. I see.
You know, what's your environmental record, your safety record? Do you have deep enough pockets to do what you say you're going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Have you got experience working in this kind of geology before?
Mm-hmm.
And based on those criteria, they make the selection.
So they do have objective criteria.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not high bidder.
No.
Let's go to Charlie, who's calling from Homer Anchor Point area. Charlie?
Hi, good morning. Well, I'm sure glad we have this program today. I'd like to direct it back to the a comparison to the Alaska system to the Norwegian system and the Kuwaiti system, and there may be others. I know the Kuwaiti has their permanent fund. They've done about the same amount of oil as we have, and they have several times as much in their permanent fund, and their citizens get several times as much dividends every year. But, you know, Section 2 of Article 8 of the Alaska State Constitution reads, "The legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of its people." And certainly none of our leaders have done that, and our oil business is not run for the maximum benefit of the people. I myself have been in oil business all my life. I'm 75 years old. The last three deals I signed with mineral rights that I own in New Mexico with oil companies that operate here in Alaska, I was given 20%, 25%, and 22.5% royalty as an individual in these leases. So the industry standard is higher than what is going on in Alaska right now. And for people to talk about lowering the tax system that we have going here is not doing what the Constitution requires that they do.
So your sense is that our take, that Alaska's take from our oil resources is too low. Let's get Rebecca Logan's response to that.
Well, I think that there are a lot of people who would argue about what the meaning of maximum benefit for the maximum benefit of Alaska's people are. You know, my thought on that is that we get as much resource development going as we can so that we have a thriving support industry, so that we have jobs for people in the state of Alaska, and so that we manage the income from that. So right now, you know, so some people see that as a strictly monetary issue. I don't. I see that as, you know, really developing. I mean, look, Norway has 230,000 people working in their resource development industry. I covet that. I wish we had.
Compared to?
Yeah, we've got about
25,000.
Well, no, that was the big topic of debate this year. What we actually had, I'd say somewhere between 15,000 and 18,000.
Okay,
it's a small number.
Let me say one more thing, and I'll get off of here and let somebody else talk.
Thanks, Charlie.
I'll let you guys finish talking. But, you know, these resources are not being developed for the maximum benefit as the Constitution requires. And there is one thing to think about. Are we going to produce all our oil? The jobs that are created, there's no income tax in this state. So the state, the people, nobody benefits from any of this development. I thank you for holding the program. I wish you'd discuss the difference between the two things and whether or not what the Norwegians are doing or what the Kuwaitis are doing is for the maximum benefit of their people. What Hickel and everybody's doing here in Alaska is not.
Well, we benefit from it in that that 90% of our government budget is paid for by it.
But let's turn to Ira. I think he wanted to add something.
At our last institute, Alaska Dialogue up in Talkeetna, the concept of maximum benefit came up over and over again. What is maximum benefit? Well, that's a concept that's evolved over the years. Back in 1969, when we got $900 million, boy, we thought that was the maximum benefit. We were just happy as can be. Over the years, our thinking has evolved on that. And certainly, one of the things we went to take a look at in Norway is, you know, how do they define that? And can that affect our thinking on that as well? We've done a very good job. I don't want to criticize it that we haven't done a good job in managing our wealth. We did the best we could with what we knew at the time. That's changing all the time. And what we learned in Norway gives us some ideas of how we might do that even better.
All right. Well, this is a great topic. And if any Alaskan doesn't have a point of view on this, then they are not participating civically, because this is the heart
it
of what we
topic.
Do.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it is.
I do.
So we're going to take a quick break here in just a second, and then come back. I'm talking with Ira Perman, who's chairman of the Institute of the North. He led this delegation of 40 Alaskans that went over to Norway to learn about how they handle their oil resources and their wealth. And Rebecca Logan, who's the general manager of the Alliance, which represents companies here in Alaska that work in the oil fields and assist the big oil companies. And she went along and learned and has another perspective on it. And we're going to want to hear your perspective, too. So I'll give out those numbers in just a few minutes. And my name is Charles Wolforth. I'm your host sitting in today for Steve Heimel. I'll be giving out those numbers, and we'll be back in just a minute as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'm sitting in today for Steve Heimel, who is out for a little while. And we are talking about Norway. Norway is a country that has a lot of similarities to Alaska. The latitude is the same. The fact that they have a lot of oil in and near Norway is the same. And they have apparently learned from Alaska that they should save a lot of their oil money and have done so. Only they've saved 10 times more, and they've developed their oil in a very different model, very different way of looking at things. So a group of Alaskans went over to learn about the Norway model, and they have come back and are here to talk about it. Ira Perman led the group. He's the chairman of the Institute of the North, and Rebecca Logan is the general manager of the Alliance, which represents the oil support industry. And we'd love to get your thoughts and comments with us as well. The phone number, if you're in Anchorage, is 550-8422. Outside Anchorage, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-8255. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And Ira, when we left, I think you were anxious to make another comment.
Well, it's this.
In response to talking about maximum use. Or
we had one of our callers brought up the discussion of the current debate about ACEs. And I just want to say, for the record, this trip was designed before that whole discussion got
ACEs
going.
ACEs is that Governor Parnell's desire to lower the taxes on the oil.
Right, and it's House Bill 110 and the debate, what should it or shouldn't it be changed. It's not difficult to take findings from this trip and apply it either way. In fact, we had people on this trip that were great advocates of rolling it back and great advocates of holding it the way it is. And each side could take something from this trip and say, aha, see, this supports that. On one side, you could say, well, goodness, they're taxing at 78%, but they still have all the same oil companies over there that we do, and they don't seem to complain. But the other side of that is, for that 78%, those Norwegian oil companies are getting a lot more for their money. They're getting the seismic provided. They're having no bids up front. The risk is greatly reduced. They have partners sharing in the risk with them. They have their whole environmental
predictability.
And it's
78% regardless of the oil price.
That's right.
We're at 115.
Like they lose their license after 6 years if they haven't performed.
If they haven't performed.
That sounds like a risk to me. I mean, because here you've got your lease, right?
There's a term on leases here now too. I think it's 10 years.
I've never heard of anybody losing one though.
That's probably true.
Unless they don't do anything. Go ahead.
My point is this: we told everybody on this trip, particularly the 12 legislators with us, leave your aces guns at the door,
right.
Keep your mind open, see what there is to see, and that's what they did.
Let's go to Brett, who's calling from Anchorage, and I guess you have family in Norway.
Yes, I do. Both my parents live in Norway. My father worked for ConocoPhillips in Anchorage, and then he was transferred to Norway, and he's been there for a couple years now, and I've gone and visited him a couple times. And I'm also a member of the UAA debate team, and we had a debate for Commonwealth North about this very topic. There was a big meeting a couple springs ago, and we had a topic. So I just wanted to remark briefly about something that Ira had said kind of early on in the show about the regulatory structures and comparing Alaska to Norway. And I actually have to disagree with something he said, because he said that it seems like the regulatory structures in Alaska are much more are rigorous. And I don't think it's so much the regulatory structures as it is that we're a litigious society. And if the Norwegians, at least in my experience when I visited them, if just taking a 30,000-foot picture, I mean, their conception of tort law is just profoundly different than ours. The idea of suing somebody for the kinds of things that we sue over is ridiculous to them, just on like a cultural level. But beyond that, one thing that I've kind of seen is that when you have things like I'll use temporary water use permits as an example. You know, the Alaska Department of Natural Resources sometimes turns around requests for temporary water use permits within 72 hours. I mean, that's about as deregulated as you can possibly get. And those don't require public comment. They don't require public review. There's no opportunity for citizens to participate in any sort of democratic process to say, no, we don't think these permits should be issued. And then that creates an adversarial relationship between DNR and DEC and then the citizenry. And when you have that adversarial relationship, that's where you get that mistrust, and that's kind of the genesis of kind of the litigious problem. Like, the reason you have organizations, say, like Trustees for Alaska, suing is because, or this is, suing on, or like, the temporary water use permits, is because citizens in Alaska sometimes feel like they don't have an opportunity to really voice their opinion on these matters. And yeah. I think that's the root of the problem.
Well,
and
with a 2,350 permit backlog in DNR, I'd be really interested to know how many of those temporary water permits got issued.
But let's take, I mean, first of all, Brett, thanks. I love the well-educated.
I know, that's what I was just thinking. I hope I never have to debate that guy. He obviously
NPR
knows his
listener.
Stuff.
Yeah,
yeah,
but
no,
I mean,
kidding.
You discussed it, the different regulatory environment, and yet when we look at the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, we learned that spill couldn't have happened in Norway because they have a whole different kind of equipment.
Let me take on this. Mm-hmm. Brett, first of all, I do agree with you. I hope I didn't give you the wrong impression. Norway has a very well-developed regulatory framework, mm-hmm. And they have very well-developed procedures, and their basis for litigating is very well spelled out and when you can do that and when it's over. And as Rebecca was saying, that happens in the front end, and there's a time to do that, and once that's done and the decisions are made, that's it. They move mm-hmm. forward, and the permitting process moves like lightning. As I said, they can get into production in 2 years.
Two to three years.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Brett, and I perceive in talking to people that their sense, and when you talk about a litigious society and having to go in and fight through a lawsuit, is that a lot of people in the environmental community feel like our Alaska state government belongs to the oil industry, and they'd give them anything they want. So, I mean, and I'm just sort of paraphrasing what I hear from people.
Oh, that's definitely how people feel.
And so, therefore, I'd
agree with that.
They feel like, well, we're not going to get a fair shake there, so we got to go to court. I mean, do you think that's true, that is a perception out there?
You know, I actually would agree with that. And I think that's one of the reasons why the environmental community, particularly in Anchorage, relies on the courts rather than perhaps using some of the other democratic mechanisms. They have this kind of visceral distrust of their elected representatives and of the organizations like DNR or even DEC. And so I think that we tend to use, I mean, I'll call it a crutch. I think we use our courts as a crutch. That's sometimes seen as the first line of defense. But it's almost like when you're comparing Alaska to Norway, it's like comparing apples to oranges, because in the conversations I've had with Norwegians, just our entire conception of litigation and the role courts serve in our society is just way, way different. Mm. I mean, the idea of here's an example I used for a Norwegian. I, you know, said if I walk onto someone's property and I jump on their trampoline and their trampoline isn't set up correctly and I fall and hurt myself, I can sue them. It doesn't mean I'm going to win, but there's certainly a chance that I could win. And that idea is just absurd to them. And so that's just one example. But I think that example also permeates into kind of their regulatory framework, like the idea of suing, the amount that we sue DNR or the amount that we sue the government for doing things that we don't like, particularly the environmental community, is problematic. And I mean, I'll just be transparent here. I'm an environmentalist. I consider myself kind of left of center.
I thought that might be the case.
What was that?
I said I thought that might be the case.
And I mean, I will completely admit that I think that using the courts as this crutch is not the right approach.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting about that is that from our perspective, it's good to hear from him that what he was just saying about that. There are so many public comment periods and public hearings, it's almost overwhelming. I mean, we get stuff on a daily basis about everything that's happening in this state. And so it just makes me wonder, do people not realize that those are happening, or do people not trust that system more?
I think probably trust.
Because it's like every day there's something, you know, that we're constantly working on. There are so many.
Let's move on because we have some other callers. Thanks for that call, Brett. That was really interesting. Next, I've got Marie calling from Sitka. And you had something to say about taxes, Marie?
Yeah, it seems like every time we turn around, it's always the cut the taxes, cut the taxes, cut the taxes. You know, and here we are, a state with all this vast wealth, and it's not even just our oil, it's our timber, it's our fish, it's our everything. And what people tend to forget in this push to cut the taxes, at the bottom line, we pay for everything we get anyway. We pay out of our paychecks for our health care. We pay our city taxes. We do all of that. And I know, at least as an individual, if I knew I was going to have my health care covered for life and I was going to have my retirement covered so I wasn't going to have to be concerned about eating dog food, I would gladly pay that 65%. You know, income tax or all these other taxes, if I knew I was going to be getting something back for it.
Well, I think that's probably something you see with Norwegians. That's been their system of operation. Like Iris said, they were doing that long before they ever had oil in the wealth. And so that system has been in place. They're used to that. They feel like they get something for their taxes. So I think they do feel that way.
And we talk about moving their model here. There's no groundswell of support for Alaskans to increase their personal taxes.
Oh my gosh, there never has been.
Is that there's a few people out there, but
I haven't heard it.
We can't save more of our oil money unless we're prepared to pay some other way, right?
Yeah. I think Alaskans are willing to pay for what they think they're getting good value for.
Yeah, and that's basically my single point is right now we're paying. And yet we still have people dying in this country because they don't even get health care.
Okay. Thanks, Marie. That was a good question, and I'm glad you brought it up. I want to turn to an email that we got from Russ, who is emailing from Haines, which is a good factual question for you guys to address about the Norway model. What quantity of oil and time frame for extracting does Norway have compared to our reserves here in Alaska? Are they scheduling their extraction to stretch out over as long a period as possible? Earlier, you made it sound like they're going all out to extract, but is that actually the case? It seems ridiculous to increase production while decreasing the amount of money we receive from it. And then he's getting into by lowering royalties from the oil companies, which unlike Norway, we don't have an ownership or an interest in. We have relatively small volume, and it will only get more valuable as time goes on. This is something I've wondered about. Why not go slower in extracting oil rather than try to hurry if we have a finite amount? How do they address that in Norway?
Well, they have gone slower. First, to answer the question of how much oil does Norway have compared to how much Alaska has, if you count all of Alaska's outer continental shelf, all the oil that we know and can project on land, it's actually fairly similar to what Norway has exclusively on its continental shelf. We came on gangbusters with Prudhoe Bay, and production went up like a rocket. And so we produced heavily in the front end, and we've been declining since, and now you've all seen that chart where it gets narrower, the band gets narrower and narrower, and we wonder whether the pipeline's going to continue to operate. That's where we are.
We sold a lot of our oil for $10 a barrel when it's now worth $100.
Norwegian's chart looks almost the opposite. It starts small on the left-hand side with their first discoveries and then grows at a more steady rate. I wouldn't call it slow, but at a more steady rate. And to the point where they peaked in 2002, something in that area. But since then, their rate of decline
They're in decline also.
They're in decline, but it's much slower. They're bringing on additional fields. They have a different extraction philosophy that keeps it going. And they project right now, they're producing about 1.7, 1.8 million barrels a day. They told us they can maintain that for 10 or 20 more years, solid.
That's another really interesting thing they have over there is this support industry that's really, really,
huge.
Really huge. And the support industry and the producers and the universities work very, very well together to do the research to come up with the new techniques, you know, for when you're looking at harder extraction. And, I mean, it's quite impressive.
Let's go to Robert. He's calling from Anchorage, and he has a question. Robert?
Yeah, hello. The impression I'm getting is that Whereas Norway has a socialist democracy, we in Alaska have a capitalist kleptocracy. So the systems are very different, and the lines of trust and the methods of decision making are quite different. Is there anything that Alaskans could learn from the Norway example that would help us improve our situation relative to the extraction of oil and the maximizing of income for the good of all the people of Alaska, as is mandated in the Constitution?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I think there were a couple big ideas that came out of that. We were talking about it off air before, but you know, I think it wasn't lost on anybody there that when there is an alignment of interest between the state and the producers, better things happen, good things happen. And then the other big idea was the state-defined, the SDFI, which I think people are going to hear a lot about, the state-defined financial interest. And that was where the Petoro, their state-owned company, makes the determination for every license they give what their percentage of ownership is going to be in that field. And so you have skin in the game, but you're investing money and you're earning money. And they don't invest with every license, but you know there are some things we can learn from that if we want to maximize our investment.
That's a very big concept and the mind-boggler for me that a country that's known for being kind of socialist is willing to invest their own capital in their fields. They decide up front, when they look at that same seismic, they say, oh, that looks pretty promising. We're going to take a 25% interest in that. And that means that Norway will reach into its pocket, pull out its wallet, and put 25% of the production of the exploration and pre-production costs on the table with all the other oil companies.
But I mean, one of the problems we've had over the years is that I think a lot of Alaskans don't trust our state government to run governments. Businesses. We haven't had or government, but we haven't had the greatest success in running businesses. In fact, I recall that the legislature decided in 2008 it was a really good time to move more of our investments into stocks. You know, it's sort of like the last possible time you'd want to do it. And so, I guess how do we overcome? Again, we're on this trust issue we talked about.
Norway doesn't invest willy-nilly in everything that it's got over there, too. But it figured out that, you know, oil and gas is a pretty good place to invest. Mm-hmm. It's our main game. It works for everybody else. We should be in the act, too. And so they did. Now, granted, it hasn't worked here for barley fields and grain elevators. We can name a lot of things. But oil and gas is our bread and butter. It's their bread and butter.
My guess is that elections in Norway are not run the way they are here with regard to funding and advertising and all the influence of money on electoral politics.
Oh, that's a good question. How do they run their elections?
They had election time going on when we were over there. Remember, right. we were walking to the parliament one day and they had the 20 different parties with all their booths up. No, it's not. And it's a very different system. It was, you know, you have the controlling party. And how long have they been, the Labor Party? Like 20 or 30 years that they've been in control.
All right. Thanks, Robert. We're going to have to take another break, and we'll be back in just a minute as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
We're back at Talk of Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'm filling in for Steve Heimel today. My guests are Ira Perman, who's the chairman of the Institute of the North, and Rebecca Logan, who's the general manager of the Alliance, which brings together oil support industry companies. We're talking about the Norway model, how they handle their oil and resources and money over in Norway compared to here in Alaska. And we've had a lively conversation. If you want to get involved, the number here in Anchorage is 550-8422. From outside Anchorage, it's 1-800-478-8255. and email us talk@alaskapublic.org. And now I'd like to go to a listener, Lindy Ann, who's calling from Homer. Lindy?
Hello.
Go ahead.
My question is Norway investing in renewable energy infrastructure with the money that it's gaining from oil? And the reason I'm asking that is it seems like Alaska, as our production goes down, that we should be using this money to create an infrastructure so that in years to come, we'll have the energy to live. And, you know, we'll all hit the wall together when we run out. Some of my best friends are petroleum engineers. Can the engineers be shifting over to renewable engineering? Can we all make this decision? Yeah,
renewable energy is huge over there. 90% of their electric power comes from hydro. I mean, they've been doing hydro forever, but I don't know how much, and maybe Ira knows, the government invests in that. You know, we went and met with a company one day that was the leader in renewable energy, specifically hydro. And so, and talking to the guys afterwards, it's a pretty common practice there that somebody develops a renewable energy project. They have a license again on that for like 15 or 20 years, and then it goes to the state. So I'm not sure how much the government invests initially in that.
Are they investing their petroleum money in, as has been suggested here, like in a Susitna Dam type project?
They already have them in place.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
What happened? Norway, of course, you're familiar with the fjords and all the streams. And many years ago, before World War II, they began their hydroelectric support. And along came World War II, and afterwards, they got a lot of Marshall Plan money, and they put that into hydro development. They have overbuilt their hydro. They have so much hydroelectric power.
It's amazing.
They export huge quantities to Sweden, to Northern Europe, to England. They're the Energizer Bunny of.
Did I hear that they actually power their oil rigs with
hydropower? That's right.
Hydropower?
They essentially take a long extension cord from the land and take it out.
It's incredible.
And run their drill rigs.
So they don't really use their own product, their oil and
gas. That's just it. They don't.
They export it.
They export. They use theirs, and that's not dissimilar to Alaska, really, but they export the vast, vast majority of it. The only liquid hydrocarbons they have is for cars and boats and airplanes. That's it. The rest is they heat and they light with hydro. It was interesting to see. I don't see so many CFL light bulbs over there. They're still using the old incandescent. They didn't worry about it.
But they're very involved in wind farms also around the world. That company is that we met with, was it Statkraft was the name of it?
Statkraft,
yeah,
that's
pretty
right.
Impressive. They're building wind farms everywhere.
A huge 9,000 megawatt farm off the coast of England that they're working on with the English. They themselves only have one windmill. And why is that? Because, well, we don't need it. We have all this hydro already.
Right.
Yes, Chris Rose from REAP was pretty excited.
I'm sure he was. Yeah, the Renewable Energy Alaska Project.
Right.
Well, thanks, Lindy Ann. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
I wanted to get into, in the final minutes we have, sort of the question of, Ira, I know you're really excited about this, and it sounds like you are to a good degree too, Rebecca. How do we change our system? How do we implement some of these ideas? Have you thought about sort of what would be the first thing you'd want to change in Alaska to move closer to what they're doing?
Well, for us, it's a question of investment. How do we get private investment going on in the state? How do we fill the pipeline, basically? We just had, as I mentioned, the Alaska Dialogue up in Talkeetna, and the number one recommendation up there is let's do what we can to fill that pipeline, yet do it consistently with Article 8, Section 2 of our Constitution, which says for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans. There's a lot of aspects to this, but I think a lot of us came away with the concept that this, what we call state's direct financial investment or interest, has some opportunities for us. And that's a whole system. That's that whole licensing versus leasing system that starts with the state doing the seismic, owning that information, taking it out to the field, making that information very transparently public, becoming a player in that. That's it. Just to get the alignment of the interests so the state and the industry are aligned, and it's not so confrontational now.
That is going to be huge. I mean, when you think about we could possibly have one of the busiest exploration seasons coming up that we've had in a long time. That's exploration. That's not production. People in those scenarios need the predictability and the stability that they've got in Norway in order to move from exploration to production. You know, we're not going to cherry pick things that are happening in Norway and impose that on existing projects that we've got going on, but we're looking at what we can do moving forward. And that SDFI is huge, but so you think about all the exploration that we could have going on and how that could impact that.
Mm-hmm. Here's a comment from email from a political scientist up in Fairbanks, Chanda Meek. notes the model Norway uses is a corporatist model where companies, unions, and the government work together to achieve joint goals. We do have a more adversarial system based on a different philosophy of the role of government and private enterprise. I think a middle ground would be a strong process of public engagement in goals and planning versus permit issuance. The present public engagement model Alaska uses for developing its oil and gas resources is not built to foster broad consensus. It's more of an information exchange model. Really good point. Now I'd like to turn to Jeff. We just have a little bit of time, Jeff, but did you have a question or comment?
I just have a quick question regarding individuals. Is there anything us as individuals can learn from what Norway's doing, what the state of Alaska is doing with our finances and the oil revenues?
Oh, I think people have to start dealing with a question. Like Iris said, you know, if we want to save the way that we do, are we willing to pay taxes? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, those are things that people have to really start considering.
So yeah. Reduced opposition to taxation. Anything you want to add, Ira?
Well, don't pin me with the tax label. Just quite
well,
so
I'm not
quickly.
Running for office, so I can say that.
Neither am I. But Norwegians do get a lot for what they pay,
and they feel like they do. Yeah.
But we also need to take a look at saving more. We're spending like crazy, and we need to save. And with that saving, start investing in our best energy prospects, and that would be that oil and gas, be that renewable in the form of hydro, geothermal, all those things. We need to be making sure that our own energy future and our industry main bread and butter is secure.
Ira's more optimistic than I am. We don't save. I wish we did. I mean, I think that's been the message forever. We need to save and stop spending like
more.
Crazy.
It's a great topic. You know, it makes you start thinking about, are we at the end of our oil era? And so we should be saying, oh, well, this would have been great if we'd done it this way. Or do we think about from today, future?
I think we can think about today to the future.
I came away thinking, boy, this is one of those woulda, shoulda, coulda things. I wish we'd done this 20 yep. years ago. But I realize this. Norway has 7 times the population, or another way to put it, we have 1/7 the population. We only need to do 1/7 as well as they do.
Right.
And we can still do that on what we
still have left.
Absolutely.
Well, great. This has been a wonderful discussion. And thanks for your call, Jeff. Did we answer your question?
Yes, you did. Thank
All right. Well, I've really enjoyed this. I'm going to be back hosting again in 2 weeks, and I'll be looking forward to it. I want to particularly thank Ira Perman, the chairman of the Institute of the North, for coming in and educating me on this topic.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been fascinating, and it sounds like the listeners were definitely interested as well. And Rebecca Logan of the Alliance, which is the oil industry support organization, bringing together a lot of companies working in natural resources in Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, and I've enjoyed being with you. Laurie Townsend will be your host next week, so please tune in. And this has been Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska, pebblepartnership.com.
And by
Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.